Shrink Wrap Radio number 385, The Science of Romantic Relationships with Dr. Sue Johnson.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Sue Johnson, PhD, is an author, clinical psychologist, researcher, professor, popular presenter, and speaker, and one of the leading innovators in the field of couples therapy. Individuals, couples, and practicing therapists all turn to Sue for her insight and guidance. She's the primary developer of emotionally focused couples therapy, which has demonstrated its effectiveness in over 25 years of peer-reviewed clinical research. As the author of the best-selling book, Hold Me Tight, Seven Conversations for a Lifetime of Love, Sue Johnson has created for the general public a self-help version of her groundbreaking research about relationships, how to enhance them, how to repair them, and how to keep them. Her most recent book, Love Sense, The Revolutionary New Science of Romantic Relationships, outlines the new logical understanding of why and how we love, based on new scientific evidence and cutting-edge research. Explaining that romantic love is based on an attachment bond, Dr. Johnson shows how to develop our, quotes, love sense, our ability to develop long-lasting relationships. Sue Johnson is founding director of the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy and distinguished research professor at Alliant University in San Diego, California, as well as professor of clinical psychology at the University of Ottawa, Canada. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Sue Johnson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, nice to be here, David.
Well, it's really nice to have you here. A couple of my former guests alerted me to your work and to its importance. Most recently, it was Dr. John Amadeo, and before that, Dr. Keith Sutton. I'm glad to finally have the opportunity to connect with you.
Hey, it's nice to talk to you.
Yes. Now, you've pioneered an approach called emotionally focused couples therapy, which is abbreviated EFCT and sometimes just EFT. What are the basic underlying principles of that approach?
The basic underlying principle is that EFT focuses on the emotional experience of relating to another person and the emotional signals that are kind of the music of the dance that, you know, couples get into and the patterns in that dance. It really prioritizes emotion. And at the time it was created, emotion was really sort of seen almost as the enemy in couples therapy. And people were talking about you had to have insight, you had to teach people negotiation skills, you had to teach people very set communication skills. And the idea was that emotion almost kind of got in the way. You had to teach people to be rational and to negotiate. And really, you know, EFT came from sitting down and watching couples, distressed couples, and then watching them as we tried to help them repair their relationship. And what we saw was that the most powerful thing in the room was the emotion that people experienced, and that primed their thoughts and it primed the way they responded to their partner. And a lot of the things that people wanted from each other, you really couldn't get to them any other way but through emotion. You can't tell people to feel love. You can't coach people to feel sexual desire and affection. You know, that just doesn't work. And people, our couples, didn't just want to negotiate about chores. They wanted some sort of secure emotional connection. So we just focused on the emotion. And really, from a long tradition, which started with Rogers, I think experiential therapists are used to working with emotion. and to helping partners or anyone, helping individuals, if you like, in therapy, reprocess that emotion, reshape that emotion. And experiential therapists also see emotion as a positive force. So EFT came out of that tradition of focusing on emotion. But if you want a shorthand, what I do in EFT is I help people move into their emotional experience, order it, distill it, and reshape it in a way that helps them send new messages to their partner, and the new messages invite that partner close rather than pushing that partner away. So we really focus on primacy of emotional communication.
Yeah. Well, all of that makes a lot of sense to me. I come out of the very much an experiential tradition myself, humanistic psychology, gestalt therapy, and a number of other approaches, so that what you're saying really resonates with me. 3 years ago, I interviewed Dr. Leslie Greenberg about his 30 years of research on emotion-focused therapy.
Yes.
And I also see that you co-wrote a book with him. What's the relationship between your work and his?
Les and I worked together to formulate the first version, the first manual of EFT for couples. Basically, I think Les has done most of his work in looking at intrapsychic change, and I think his work is very significant in looking at intrapsychic change, whereas I just became completely obsessed with couples and dyadic change and helping couples and working with these. So it's almost like we sort of work together, and then I kind of just became obsessed with couples. And the other thing that happened, which I think is very significant for EFT for couples, is that I became obsessed with the beginnings of adult attachment theory and research, which really, when we first wrote the first manual for EFT for couples, there wasn't anything in the literature about adult attachment, nothing. And it was only when I started looking at what was happening in EFT and realizing how powerful it was, it was much more powerful. I sort of didn't quite know what was going on, but I knew that something very powerful was going on, and I couldn't quite explain it. Then when I started reading some of the very early people like Phil Shaver writing about adult attachment, suddenly it all made sense. So as EFT for couples has developed, it's become more and more attachment orientated, and adult attachment has grown as a field. So the two fields have kind of grown together to the point where, to be honest, I'm a researcher and I'm a presenter and I'm a couples therapist. But if you really ask me, I'd say I'm an attachment researcher and theorist, and EFT is the only approach to working with relationships that is based on a broad, deeply articulated, massively researched developmental theory of personality and relationship. It is the only approach to couples therapy that has that kind of base. We have a map to what love is all about. And so I think that gives us an amazing edge. I have a map to people's inner experience of longing and pain. And I have a map to the interactions that are going to get people completely stuck in that pain, or the interactions that can take people into more secure bonding. And that map is attachment theory.
Fascinating, fascinating. We'll get into attachment theory some more as we go along. I'm struck by the confidence of the statements that you just made. It sounds like you have a lot of confidence when you say, I have a map.
And, yeah. Well, you know, I do have a lot of confidence, and we have 16 outcome studies now and about 9 process of change studies, and they're all on our website, www.iceeft.com, and also there's a new website out, drsuejohnson.com, that has some clips on our most recent studies, particularly on a brain scan study we just did. But I do have a lot of confidence because I think every time I walk in, never mind the studies, every time I walk in with a new couple, I feel that I'm not starting from scratch. I'm not, you know, I know the kinds of things this couple are going to say. I know how to interpret the look on the man's face. I almost know where this couple needs to go. Now, that being said, each couple is also, you know, the couple teach you about their reality and their longings. But nevertheless, what attachment says is that we have certain responses that are wired into our brains by millions of years of evolution. You know, we are all terrified of rejection and abandonment, and we all depend on our most intimate partners in a way that is intimately linked to our very sense of emotional survival. And that really does give me, or any EFT therapist, a really, what John Bowlby, the father of attachment theory, would say, a secure base to stand on when a couple or a family or even an individual talking about relationship problems, when these people come and start to talk to you, you know, it's like you really do have a secure base of understanding about what these relationships are all about and what people's needs are. And you're right, David, that does... it does give me a lot of confidence. You know, when I say to a couple, yes, I understand how stuck you feel right now, and we know how to help you out of this. We know how to take you here. It feels very, very good to be able to say that. And certainly, we've worked very hard for that. I mean, I didn't start there. Perhaps one of the reasons I got so hooked... You know, I started not knowing what to do at all, right?
Sure. Well, you know, having been in that situation and not having developed the same set of skills that you have, or not having had this map to work from, there you are with two or more people and emotions are flying all over the place. And so I can understand that it really helps to have a map and a solid place to stand on. Now, as you move through this therapy, there must, in your map, I would imagine that there are sort of stages of therapy that unfold. And maybe you can take us through what the major stages of your approach are.
Yes. Well, basically, we try to create a safe alliance, and we're also guided by attachment theory there, in that we stay emotionally present with the people in the room, we validate them, we try to really help them feel safe so that they know that they're going to be supported and not blamed. We assess the couple, and that is written up very well in the EFT literature. In the basic 2004 book, The Practice of Emotionally Focused Couples Therapy, and the workbook that goes along with it, and the case book that goes along with that, that assessment procedure is well written up. But then we go, really, that's part of stage one, which we call de-escalation. And what we're trying to do is de-escalate the negative cycles of interaction that people have created and are now stuck in, cycles like one person's criticizing and blaming, basically in order, from an attachment point of view, to get a response from the other person. And the other person feels criticized and blamed, and this hurts. And we know from recent research that that's not a metaphor. that rejection in the mammalian brain is really processed as a danger cue, and it's processed in the same place and in the same way as physical pain, because isolation from others is dangerous for mammals, and our brain is wired to understand that right from the beginnings. So, you know, we take the couple into their relationship. We show them the patterns they get stuck in. One person criticizes, one person withdraws because they don't want to be rejected and to hear they're disappointing. And the more one person withdraws, the more the other person ups the ante and criticizes. We help them see these kinds of patterns, and we help them understand that the problem in the relationship is the dance they are caught in, not the fact that they don't have any skills or that there's something wrong with them from their family history, or that they're somehow deficient as partners, inherently deficient as partners. We help them understand the dance, and we help them understand the emotional music that's going on, the desperateness underneath criticism, and the feeling of hopelessness and failure that mostly underlies withdrawal in intimate relationships. And we get to the point, where we can have the couple have a meta perspective on the relationship, understand things from the point of view of attachment, understand the impact they have on each other, and start to help sort of stand together and look at the enemy, look at the dance, and begin to make sense of what's going on, feel more confident about what's that they can impact this, and create a secure base in their own relationship. And that's stage one. So people say things like, our relationship's improved incredibly. I used to think he just didn't care. Now I understand that he doesn't know what to do and he gets scared. I never really meant to hurt him, you know, and somehow we're more affectionate and we feel better about our relationship, and nothing's really changed. And they're right. They're right, yeah. Because what we've done is we've contained the negative. We've contained the dance they get into that constantly puts them into what we call attachment panic, puts them into rejection and abandonment. We've contained it. They've contained it. So now if you stop there, and I think lots of couples therapies, you know, from our point of view, do stop there. If you stop there, there's been some improvement in the relationship, but our assumption is that they will relapse, because the heart of EFT is the second stage, which is restructuring attachment. And in the second stage, we help the couple create a positive cycle of interaction where each person can tune into their own emotions, keep their emotional balance, make sense of those emotions, and learn to turn and reach for the other person in a way that pulls that person close. And we call that withdraw re-engagement, blame or soften. That's what it's called in the therapy literature. When we talk to the public, we call that a hold me tight conversation. And what we know is that when couples learn to do this, learn to reach for each other and talk about their needs and their fears from an attachment point of view, that this predicts that at the end of therapy, they will be out of distress, they will have repaired their relationship. And in our most recent study, which isn't published yet, we've also shown that we can help them create a more secure attachment bond. So that is very promising, because all the research says that secure attachment bonds are associated with every positive indices of healthy psychological functioning you can imagine, from assertiveness to the ability to deal with stress, to the ability to deal with ambiguous information, to empathy for others, on and on and on and on and on. So we feel that these conversations not only heal relationships, they create relationships that heal and grow people. I think Rogers would have liked that.
And then the third
stage is consolidation, where we basically help the couple see what they've done, celebrate what they've done, and create a new model for their relationship so that they can take these to the future. And at this point, my institute has created over the years quite a large number of training tapes where we show these kinds of stages and we show the EFT interventions because, you know, we've spent a lot of energy making this model available to therapists, you know, so that, there's no point in having a model that you think is on target and really helpful if it stays on a shelf in a library or, you know, only 20 therapists know how to do it.
Right. Have you ever sold vacuum cleaners or washing machines or something? Because you're quite a good salesman. I'm really sold here. Oh, yes. Now, it makes me wonder, though, are there any critics of EFT? And if so, what's their criticism?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, EFT is the only approach, apart from the behavioral approaches, that has real strong empirical validation. So my behavioral colleagues, I'm not quite sure what they'd say. I think traditionally they have taught that you teach communication skills and negotiation skills, and then the latest model put out by Andy Christensen teaches that you end up teaching the couple to accept the negative behaviors that they can't change. And they would say that, I'm not sure they use it to criticize us. They would say that if you do this, the couple will be fine, and perhaps that as satisfaction goes up, the attachment bond will just naturally get better. The trouble with that one is all the research is in the other direction. What the research on attachment says is that it's secure attachment that creates satisfaction. That's the direction there. It's not the other way around. You can have some satisfaction in a relationship, but if that doesn't translate into being able to reach for somebody and get the support you need, that satisfaction isn't going to last very long. It's going to disintegrate. So they don't agree, I don't think, about the power of attachment. And perhaps those folks would say that learning cognitive skills is as powerful as working with emotion. For me, that is just a non-argument. Every human being on this planet knows that emotion, especially in intimate relationships, is the most powerful thing there is. It's the music of the dance.
Yeah, and we've learned through recent brain science that emotion is faster than cognition, right?
Oh, yeah. And it's compelling.
and that's why arguments and so on can flare up so quickly and offense can be taken so quickly and so deeply.
That's right. And, you know, so I think they would say that. There are also some folks who have different models of therapy who don't have any research. Some people object to attachment. Some of the more traditional Bowenian folks would say that they focus on individuation and differentiation, for example. I believe that David Snarch suggests that we are turning people into needy children, which I find very strange because our couples don't look like needy children at the end of therapy. They look like very well-functioning adults. But, you know, the key issue there is attachment says that you differentiate and individuate with people, not from people, and that we are strongest when we can reach for others and use others as a resource. And the research behind that is enormous. So my response to those folks is to say, show me the research, right?
Yeah, all right. Well, and that's such a breakthrough too. I mean, it's been a lot of years of hard work, but I think, you know, going back to the 60s when I was in training and graduating and so on, and had a strong emotional faith and reliance on experiential work. But the research wasn't there, and that was always the criticism that was being brought to people who came from that kind of point of view. And now people like you and like Leslie and others have really done the hard work to establish these principles that rest on research. Now, you go through a lot of this in your latest book, which is titled, the main title of the book is Love Sense. And
yes,
I wonder about those two, Love Sense, if that's a play on words. What are you getting at with that title?
What I'm getting at is that all through recorded human history, poets and philosophers and psychologists as well have talked about romantic love as a mystery. And of course, we don't quite trust mysteries. You know, you don't want to base your life on a mystery. So, you know, they talked about romantic love as a mystery. And what I'm really getting at this title is that at this point in time, because of the last 20 years, hang on a minute.
Sure.
Because of the last 20 years, love simply isn't a mystery anymore. We understand it, and we understand what it's about. We understand how it goes wrong. We understand how to repair it. We understand how important it is and why. And, you know, this is an enormous breakthrough. And the promise in that is that if love makes sense, then you can understand it and shape it and learn how to do it.
And so
I think in this world, that's huge, because we count on our partners in a way that nobody in human civilization has ever done before. We don't live in small villages. We don't live in massively supportive communities that give us a web of familiarity and support from the time we are born to the time we die. We really ask our partner to provide the kind of emotional connection and support that my grandmother got from a village. And I think that puts romantic love on a whole new footing in terms of survival and importance in people's lives. You know, I read a survey that said that marriage has changed, and women used to basically ask what kind of provider you were going to be. And the recent survey said that it was more important for women that a man talk about his emotions than how much money he made and whether he was going to provide for them. And I think, you know, marriage has moved from being an economic enterprise to an emotional enterprise. It's the main way we get these needs for emotional connection and security met as adults in our society. And if you believe,
let me ask you a question. Is that putting too great a burden on the relationship to have to supply what a village and what a community used to supply?
Well, it is if you don't know how to do it.
Okay.
But you know, I feel like what we do is we EFT, the reason that EFT is powerful is not because all EFT therapists are so clever and magical, or because, you know, we're super master therapists, we sort of all gurus. That's not the reason why EFT is powerful. The reason EFT is powerful, I believe, is because we tune in to the most powerful, unconditioned motivation in human beings, which is, and much more powerful than sex and aggression, by the way, which is the need for safe emotional connection and caring from another human being. And the point about that one is, if we know, if we understand that, and we know how to deal with that, and we know how to operationalize that in a relationship, you know, is amazingly satisfying for people. People, when we watch our couples, when one person is really able to turn and reach for the other person, what we see is this naturally evokes amazing empathy and caring in the other person to the point where they want to give, they like to give. You know, we like holding babies. I mean, babies are like a little magnet. We look at them, we stare at them, we hold them. Nature is brilliant. It's made that kind of connection rewarding for the giver, you know, and as well as for the person who's receiving. So I think it can be, it's like everything else. If you don't understand what's going on, understand your own needs, we've actually taught people to be rather ashamed of their needs for caring and closeness as adults, that they're not supposed to depend on other people, then yes, you're right. This can be an awful struggle, and it is too much for people. But if we give people a map and we help them understand how to do it, then that's different. You know, it's happened in parenting, you know, David. This revolution that I'm talking about in the book, In Love Sense, I mean, attachment theory has revolutionized parenting in the Western world in the last 50 years. We no longer just drop our kids off at the hospital and leave them there. We know how traumatizing that would be for them. And, you know, attachment as a developmental theory has totally changed the way we deal with our children. And what I'm really trying to do in Love Sense is to really bring that kind of revolution into our adult love relationships. I believe that attachment and the enormous amount of research on adult love that's happened in the last 15 years really can create a whole new model of romantic relationships and will revolutionize those in much the same way as parenting's been revolutionized in the last 50 years.
Well, what audience did you have in mind when you decided to write this book?
Everyone. Therapists, because therapists work with people and help people who actively are seeking to improve their relationships. But really, Love Sense is a bit different from Hold Me Tight, which I wrote about 5 years ago, which was taking all that we'd learned in EFT for couples and trying to give it to ordinary folks for them to work on their relationship. Love Sense is a bit different. It's kind of a big idea book. It's like saying to people, there's all this research and all this science, and we really can understand love. And it's trying to reach people who maybe just want to understand how love works. They don't necessarily want to change their relationship right now. It's trying to reach a broader audience, I guess, to have people have a new model of romantic love, not just trying to reach the people who are actively trying to work on a specific relationship.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really like about your book and your approach is that it builds so heavily on attachment theory, which you have been emphasizing. And somehow, I don't think it had really occurred to me before to look at adult relationships through the lens of attachment theory.
Yes.
Which in the past has focused so much on the early years. You say that attachment is really the heart of the matter.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I think we've had this kind of blind spot. You know, it's we've been very enamored with the idea that somewhere around 12, you become something called independent. And I think in our individualistic society, we've really gone with this idea that adults are self-sufficient and should be autonomous and self-sufficient, and this is a sign of health. Whereas in fact, you know, a well-functioning adult is someone who knows how to do what is the most brilliant adaptive strategy of the human species, which is to turn to someone else and use them for emotional support. And as my friend Jim Cohn would say, I'll tell you about our brain scan study in a minute. He worked on the study with me. He's a neuroscientist. He would say, turn and borrow other people's brains.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, by the way, let me have you back away from the mic a little bit. I think we're overdriving it a little
bit. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Not a big problem.
So, you know, so really what I'm talking about in the book is that there's been this enormous paradigm shift, and that people really, research scientists have started to see that as adults, of course, we are different from children. You know, as adults, we can think of our partners and think of our attachment figures and find comfort just in representation. You know, and often we do that when we are uncertain, or life becomes too much, or we become anxious, or we become confused about what to do. When we feel like we don't have enough resources, if you think about it, often we like have conversations in our head with people that we depend on, people we love. It's like those people are always alive in our heads, even when they're not physically present. A child needs the attachment figure to be present. An adult doesn't. The other issue is that there's a sexual component to an adult attachment relationship. But that being said, if you look at romantic love, the similarities with the parent-child relationship are striking. You know, in both forms of relationship, people seek and desire emotional and physical proximity, and become very upset when the person is unavailable, unresponsive, distant, and to the point where they become very angry, or they become very, very anxious. Right? And this, we call it separation protest. It's the same in those relationships. Emotional responsiveness and accessibility build a secure sense of bonding and connection. That's the same in both those relationships. Both of those relationships offer people a safe haven from anxiety, a feeling of being cared for, and not being alone in the world. Both of those relationships actually support people to feel confident and to be able to go out into the world. This is a paradox. You know, it's like, how do you get an independent child? You allow the child to depend on you and learn that other people are safe and that their emotions are manageable and that they're not alone in the world. And it's the same with adults. How do you get an autonomous adult? You give that adult support. John Bowlby called this effective dependency. There's a beautiful study by Feeney. Young career women who felt supported by their partner and felt they could reach for their partner were more confident when they went out to face challenges. They were more sure of themselves because someone else had their back. And they were more resilient to stress, and they reached their career goals faster. So we've kind of been obsessed with independence, but what Bowlby would say is, we're wired for dependency. We're wired to reach out for others, and that's a strength for us. But we can do it in a way that makes us stronger as individuals, or we can not know how to do it and get caught in all kinds of struggles, which, you know, isn't good for anybody.
Yeah, the emphasis that has existed on children in terms of early attachment experiences with parental figures, the notion really has been that that would really strongly color subsequent relationships in adulthood. So it kind of raises the question, to what extent can we override or reprogram these?
I think that's a very good question. And the old view of attachment, sort of from way back, before the adult attachment literature really got going, was that, you know, you were kind of programmed as a child in your main relationships, and then you just kind of followed that program all through your life, and that really all therapy could do was kind of give you insight into that. This is pretty old hat now. The new research says that, of course, we can change our models of relationship. In fact, Bowlby said that adaptive working models of relationship and of self are adaptive precisely because they can be revised. And if you like, what I say in the book is that one of the amazing things about romantic love is that it's perhaps our main chance to revise those feelings about ourselves and other people, mm-hmm. our beliefs about relationships. It's our main chance to revise them. And the research says we can revise them. We do revise them. And in fact, we've just done a study that says that we can revise them in emotionally focused couples therapy.
Yeah. In fact, you say love shapes the brain, and you even refer to neurons of love. What are you getting at there?
Well, I think what I was referring to there is that people like Cozzolino and Alan Shroof and some of these guys who, you know, really look at the developmental underpinnings of adult attachment, I mean, what they're basically trying to talk about is that we are born small and helpless and vulnerable. We are born as beings that if we call and no one comes, we literally die. And so emotional isolation is coded in our brain as a danger cue, and emotional connection is coded as a safety cue. And just on that very basic level, that is, you know, that is not just a psychological reality, that's a physiological reality. You know, Jack Panksepp, who's an emotion theorist and researcher, he talks about the fact that there's actually a special pathway for a special kind of fear in the mammalian brain. And this pathway is reserved to respond when attachment figures, especially your main attachment figure, is perceived as somehow unavailable and unresponsive. And it's a danger cue. So our need for caring has shaped the neural pathways in our brain. And then, of course, it works the other way, too. The neural pathways in our brain shape, you know, who we are and our relationships. So if you work with a trauma survivor in couple therapy, and we've worked with depression and with anxiety, you can find all the studies on the ICEFT website. If you work with a trauma survivor, you know, whose brain has been wired to desperately want closeness because the world is a pretty dangerous place and they need that reassurance, but also when they're offered that closeness, suddenly there's another neural pathway that takes over and they feel at risk. They want closeness, but then when it's offered, they say, oh my God, this is too dangerous. And the EFT therapist expects that and has to be able to deal with the ambiguity and help the client deal with the ambiguity and help the client's partner understand the ambiguity. So, you know, this is, emotion is physiological and this stuff is physiologically wired in. The wonderful thing about all this is, you know, whether we're talking about neurons or emotional responses or therapy, what I'm trying to say in Love Sense is all this is making sense. All these studies and clinical insights and, you know, studies with kids in the lab and studies with adults at airports, they're all singing the same song.
There's a kind of convergence going on, I think, isn't there?
Yes. That's the word. That's the word, David. Yes. So this empowers me as a therapist, You know, and EFT continues to grow as a model. I mean, we're very proud of this new brain scan study we've done. I don't know if you want to talk about that, but I think it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Tell us what you found.
Okay. So it was part of the attachment study to show that we could not only change satisfaction in relationships, but we could take unhappy, unsatisfied, insecurely attached people who really didn't feel comfortable emotionally connecting with their partner and didn't trust their partner, and we could change them into more secure attachment in a 20-session, study, 20 sessions of EFT. So we wanted to show this on lots of levels. We gave them questionnaires and we gave them a task to do and we coded it. And that isn't out yet. That data isn't out yet. But it was very positive. We found that we could indeed help both anxiously attached and avoidantly attached partners feel more securely connected with their lover. But the other thing we did was we put the women, and we only put the women in because we didn't have enough money to put the men in as well, okay?
Okay.
So we put the women in a brain scan machine before therapy. And we told them, and this is on the website if people want to look at it, there's a little YouTube about it. We told them, when you see an X in front of your face, there's a 20 to 30% chance you'll be shocked on your ankles. And we left them alone in the machine, and when they see the X, their brain goes crazy, and if they get the shock, they say it hurts. And we had a stranger hold their hand when they saw the X, and again, their brain went crazy, and the shock hurt. And we had their husband hold their hand, and again, their brain went berserk, and the shock hurt. The husband is not a safety cue. Then we give them 20 sessions of EFT and they go through these hold me tight conversations where they can reach for each other and comfort each other and support each other. And what happens is when the women are alone in the machine after therapy, their brain goes berserk. When they see the X, the shock hurts. When the stranger holds their hand, it's a little bit better than it was before therapy. Their brain goes a little bit less berserk. Shock hurts a little bit less. But when their husband holds their hand and they see the ex, nothing happens in their brain. And they report that the shock is uncomfortable.
Fascinating.
And this,
of course,
yes, it is.
Some people out there are going to be thinking, you psychologists are always shocking people.
I know, it's true. But what is interesting about this is the prefrontal cortex in those women didn't turn on. The implication is, it wasn't that their husband's hand-holding, after all this intimacy building, it wasn't that it helped them control the fear more or cope with the fear better, because if that was true, the prefrontal cortex would be all lit up and working like mad.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, the touch of the husband changed how the threat was encoded at source. And that is very powerful, and it fits beautifully with what John Bowlby talked about, which is this intimate connection with other people creates a safe haven for us. It literally turns the world into a less dangerous place. It changes how we perceive threat because we're not alone.
Beautiful. I want to go back to something you said earlier when you were saying we're not gurus. And, you know, one test of your map is how trainable this approach is. So
yeah.
talk to that a bit. And have you done any research that would show the efficacy of being able to train other therapists in these skills?
Funny you should ask that, David, because I'm very honored. I just got the Professional Training Award from the American Association of Marital and Family Therapists.
What a setup. And you didn't even...
I can't resist telling you that. Sorry.
Yeah.
But actually, I think we're one of the few models that... Yes, recently in the Journal of Marriage and Family Therapy, some of my Californian colleagues... I can't can't remember now whether it was two studies or three, please forgive me, but they did do some research on how people experienced our basic four-day externship, which is the basic training in EFT. And it was very interesting. People reported that they felt much more competent with their clients, but they also reported that had impacted their own relationships and their own way of dealing with those relationships.
That's not surprising. That's a good outcome. It's not surprising, though.
But in answer to your question, I feel very proud of the fact that EFT really is unique in the amount of focused attention that we have given in the last decade to creating resources to teach this model, training tapes, and we get amazing feedback from our seminars, and you can become registered, you can become certified as an EFT couples therapist. It's all on the website. That pathway to certification, is very well trodden and well thought out, and we know how to teach people these skills. You know, it's not a simple model. It's not like, this model doesn't say there's five questions you ask and you always ask them and people will you'll create a miracle. We don't believe in that. People are complex, and the dances they dance with their partner are complex. But we feel very good about the training that we can give. And I think it's evidence that this work is translatable, in that it's not just me who's done these studies and gets these outcomes. You know, other people have done the studies in different parts of the country. Wayne Denton, he moves around. I can't remember exactly where he is now, but he's in the southern states somewhere. Europe, this stuff translates. It's incredibly popular in China. Hmm. And, of course, you have to adapt it to the culture that you find yourself in. But, yes, I think we can train. All the evidence is we can train people. And we also have built a community. Because, after all, if you believe in safe haven, secure base, you believe that people need connection, we have a EFT listserv. If you do our externships, you are welcome to join our community. We put out a newsletter. The listserv is amazingly supportive to people. We really believe in constant learning and in supporting people to create EFT communities. We have, I think, about 35 centers all over the world now, which were initiated by the people in those communities. And what we do at ICEFT is we just support them. We do webinars for them and, share our resources. And so we try to create this safe haven, secure base community for therapists to learn. So I think actually we've done more in that model from that point of view of training than any other model I know. And that's because we really take attachment seriously. We've created a team. We really do believe that people are better together. So, I have 35 trainers who are the most amazing group of people and who are all over the world and who travel all over the world, from Korea to Australia to Finland.
We're back to the village and the security of the village.
We are, aren't we? Back to the village, yes. All because I was born in an English pub,
Yes, right. I was struck by that. Now, what about on the client side? You've done such a good sales job here. What if somebody's listening to this and they're in a troubled couple relationship? How would they go about finding somebody that you've trained in or trained by one of your trainers in their own area?
Oh, they would go to the ICEFT website, and they would look at the therapist by area list, and they would find somebody in that community. Or if they could not find someone, they would call us in Ottawa or their nearest center. If they live near New York, they'd call the New York EFT Center or the San Francisco EFT Center or the San Diego EFT Center and ask someone there, you know, listen, I live in this area. Could you please tell me, you know, if there's therapists who not be on the website yet, but who have indeed been trained in this model, and we will help you. You know, there are some areas that have less EFT therapists than others. There don't seem to be many EFT therapists in Alaska.
I think,
don't know why.
Well, people have the cold there to bond them together. They need to cuddle and stay warm.
It's 40 below here today, David.
Oh, my goodness. You're in Ottawa right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. 40 below?
Yeah, it's too cold, okay.
My goodness.
So anyway, I'm sort of looking at your questions here. I'm wondering, I'm looking at some of the questions.
Yeah, there's time to hit another one or two. So if you see some, just let people know. I don't always share the questions that I've made up with the guests, but sometimes my intuition says it would be a good idea. So I did share that with you.
Well, one of the things maybe that comes up a little bit is I want to say that we also have, a few years ago, we did research on forgiveness and forgiveness of wounds in the relationship. But people focus a lot on affairs, but affairs are not the only wounds in a relationship. And I think from an attachment point of view, it really helps you understand the wounds that happen. You know, wounds happen when someone we care about and need to be with us at a particular moment in time abandons us or is not there for us. A good example came up in our research was women go through miscarriages, and for the man, it's a medical emergency, and he goes into high coping mode and into quite sort of rational detachment often, and the woman, her baby died. And she needs emotional connection at that point. And if the couple cannot talk about this afterwards and heal this rift, it really can really start to unravel the bond between them. And so we did a whole research project on what we call attachment injuries and helping couples heal these injuries. And I mean, I think that's one of the examples of how if you have an understanding of human bonding, adult bonding, it really does give you a way of understanding why people get so hurt, what the hurt's about, and what is necessary, what needs to happen to heal those injuries. You know, it's you can talk about injuries like that until you're purple, and people do. You know, it doesn't change anything. You have to have a new experience of bonding. You have to have a new experience of expressing your pain to that person and having them this time hear you and respond. From our point of view, that's the only thing that heals those bonds. You can't heal them any other way.
Now, so, are you saying that that's a component of forgiveness, that forgiveness is possible?
Yes. I'm saying forgiveness is possible, but you have to do it on an emotional processing level. Mm-hmm. You have to address the original pain. And you have to have the other person this time respond to that pain in a very particular way, in an emotionally engaged way. Mm-hmm. If you look at most of the forgiveness literature, it's amazingly cognitive.
Oh, I see, yes. So,
and it's amazingly moral. And from our point of view, it misses the point. Forgiveness is an emotional process between two people. So that was very rewarding research. You know, I feel like we learned a lot from that research. And, you know, that's one of, I mean, I'm basically a clinician. And the reason I do research is because I learn so much about how relationships work. And from every research study, you know, we learn. And so that was one that I think we found very, very rewarding.
Well, I'm glad that you shared that with us, and maybe this is a good place for us to wrap it up. You've been extremely generous with your time. And
most welcome.
Yeah, I've really appreciated the opportunity to speak with you. So, Dr. Sue Johnson, thanks for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're most welcome. Happy New Year to you, David.
Oh, thank you. You too. Wow, what a fire hose of information Dr. Sue Johnson is. As you heard me say repeatedly, her approach makes a lot of sense to me. It really reinforces the sense of convergence of neuroscience and psychotherapy that we've been seeing across many of our interviews. Attachment theory also has become almost a leitmotif running through many of these interviews as well. Attachment theory provides a bridge between psychodynamic ideas going all the way back to Freud and up to the present, and a growing number of brain studies that validate those notions. A good example is the brain study she shared with us where women received mild shocks and the brain scans were able to reveal the pre- and post-therapy effectiveness of EFT between the wives and the husbands. There's a lot more material in her book than we were able to cover in this interview. I highly recommend this book to all therapists, especially those who work with couples and families. You'll find plenty of the science in the book that underlies her work. At the same time, it's deliberately written to appeal to a popular audience as well. Who among us doesn't crave better attachment with our loved ones? I think this book could be a catalyst for those in troubled relationships to get the couple talking about these ideas and perhaps even to search out an EFT-oriented therapist. As always, you can use the Amazon widget on our site should you decide to order it. By the way, you'll need to scroll further down in the right-hand sidebar of our site than in the past to see that Amazon widget.
Dr. Dave has given me many hours of interesting listening with his amazing podcasts. This week, I finally clicked on the support button on his website and sent a gift. Maybe you would like to send Dr. Dave a gift in this season of giving to show your appreciation for all his work. It feels good to give back to someone who gives so much. Think about it. It's worth doing.
Thank you, Carrie, for that wonderful endorsement and call to action. Indeed, I want to thank all of you who make either ongoing or one-time donations. As you may know, I'm listing the names of those who donate on our honor roll, which you can find under the Support tab on our site. I'm in the process of updating that page for 2014. Those of you who are making ongoing donations should still find your name there. Those who gave occasional or one-time donations during 2013 will need to make at least one more donation during 2014 to get their names back on the honor roll. I'd love to see you all up there, and don't forget, we have the new guilt-free option for a mere $12 a year. I'm happy to announce that we have a new transcript on the site, thanks to listener Margarita. It's number 376, A Psychodynamic Understanding of Personality Structure with Dr. Nancy McWilliams. Look for it on the transcripts page. Also, after a long period of no new continuing education courses, I'm happy to announce a new 6-unit continuing education course through the Zur Institute. It's called The Psychology of Relationships, Promoting Intimacy with Couples, Children, and Adolescents. You'll find a link to this new course by clicking on the Store tab at shrinkwrapradio.com. I've decided to close the poll we were running on our site for the past several weeks. You'll recall the poll asked whether you want me to go back to playing a brief excerpt of the upcoming interview at the beginning of the show, a practice known as billboarding. Well, the results are in. I had hoped a lot more of you would go to our website and vote, but we only had a total of 22 votes. 5 of you voted to go back to the billboarding that I used to do, 8 of you said no, and 9 said you were fine either way. So despite the small sample, I'm declaring this a victory for continuing the status quo. And now I'm putting up a new poll, which I hope I will get more guidance from. For a while, I used to give a fairly short bio intro of my guest just before the interview itself. Not long ago, I heard from a listener who requested that I go back to the way I did it when I first started the show, and which has been my current practice for a while now, which is that I read usually several paragraphs of biographical data about the guest. Some people appreciate the detail and really knowing the guest's credentials. Others appreciate getting into the interview more quickly. So the question is, which do you prefer? Several paragraphs of bio info about the guest? Just a sentence or two? Or you're fine either way? You'll find a poll in a red box in the right-hand sidebar on the site. You have to scroll way down. This is your show, and I want it to be the way you want it. So please vote.
Hi, this is Christopher Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thanks again, Chris, father of our newest grandchild, Alexandra Van Nuys, who celebrates her first birthday tomorrow. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Barclay, who writes, "Dear David, recently I found a new and deeper meaning of the word appreciation toward what is precious or toward what holds value. As much as I love words and their origins, and as much as I am an ardent fan of the power of gratitude and appreciation, I'd never before tuned into that particular etymology. The phrase or the mantra has continued to come to mind in a variety of situations, the most recent of which has me up and writing to you in the wee hours. When I wake up for a while in the night, I often listen to one of your trusty podcasts for accompaniment. Sometimes I'll soon drift off to sleep again with interesting thoughts and the reassuring tone of your conversations. And other times, when I might be more wakeful, I'll enjoy listening to much or all of an interview. Because of this irregular listening pattern, I might return to one conversation several times in order to be sure that I've covered all of it. I especially did not want to miss anything from number 380 with John C. Robinson on the Three Secrets of Aging. Because of my primary focus as a psychologist in the area of adult development, I have strong convictions about the ongoing growth and development we can experience across the entire lifespan. As well with my particular interest in the convergence of psychological and spiritual experience, I was further interested in John Robinson's perspective since he'd completed doctoral training as both a psychologist and as a minister. Since discovering Shrink Wrap Radio nearly 3 years ago, I've admired the way that you and the so-called retirement chapter of your life have instead created a whole new rich and valuable body of work with your interview podcasts. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. She goes on to say, beyond the confines of academia, free to follow the dictates of your own creative curiosity, you have taken an elegantly simple idea to talk with a wide variety of professionals involved in different aspects of psychology, and you have generated a global network of loyal listeners, along with an extensive archive of spoken wisdom about an exciting array of dovetailing interests. In the context of such an ambitious and generous endeavor, I found myself quite intrigued with the many and varied ways you've tried to inspire some fair measure of reimbursement from your listeners. As someone who is very much rooting for you to achieve a sustainable balance of effort and return, I've found myself concerned that you've needed to focus so frequently on the volume of work you do, which frankly sounds far more like full-time than like half-time, and what financial return you receive, which sounds like a somewhat skimpy response from those who gain so much from your show. I've empathized with your ethic of generosity, applauded your mission to maintain access to your educational podcasts without charge, and hoped that donations from each according to his ability to pay were flowing to you in a steady stream. I was interested to hear you describe your new donation option, the guilt-free $12 a year choice. As I listened to you describe how the value of all you offer must certainly be worth $1 per month, which the vast majority of people can afford, I could feel myself moving toward a new decision about what kind and what level of contribution I myself want to make to you this year in order to demonstrate my appreciation for the meaningful and ongoing gift of your podcast. Pondering your challenge, I couldn't help but think what you could be earning per hour if you were in practice, helping one person at a time, compared to what you deserve to receive through donations, helping thousands of people per hour. So while still listening in the comfort of bed this morning, I promised to myself to get to the website today to press the support button to express my gratitude. I realized that I like the idea of guilt-free listening, and also I recognize that it would make me feel good to send an ongoing donation to you since your own efforts are definitely ongoing. I knew that for me, $1 per month was not the right amount. It didn't feel like enough. I needed to choose a larger amount, but one I could sustain in an ongoing way. I thought of my belief that we need to donate to those places and people that provide us with greatest inspiration. I thought again of the new and deeper meaning for appreciation toward what is precious. By this time, I was nearing the end of the podcast, and when I heard you mention that you'd recorded your comments on Thanksgiving Day, I decided it was high time to leave the warmth of my bed and take care of my donation now. I pulled on a robe and went straight to my computer, still with my earbuds in place, as I heard you expressing gratitude for your family along with your fans. Then, at the precise point I was sitting down to begin an email to you, I heard you mention my name. At that very moment, you were actually reading a note of appreciation I'd written about the stirring interview with your son, Jonathan. It felt like the perfect message of confirmation to have an experience of such synchronicity. Then, for one more finishing touch, about an hour later, I noticed one additional external confirmation about my donation decision. When I went back to the bedroom to finish getting dressed and make the bed, I was admiring the colors on a trio of books by Robert Parker, my husband's favorite mystery writer, that only yesterday had been placed in a new corner of the room. And suddenly I noticed the middle book's title, Shrink Wrap. These words and my recurring donation decision come to you with great appreciation in the fullest sense of the word. And that's from Barclay, who splits her time between Ocala, Florida and Colusa, California. And it's so meaningful to me to hear from you, Barclay, a fellow psychologist, and you have expressed your appreciation so eloquently and really given words to what I've been trying to say about effort versus return and so on, and you've confirmed my own feelings about it in such a good way. And I love the synchronicities that you cited, and I have to add one more because you mentioned that you saw the title Shrink Wrap on the mystery book of your husband's favorite author, mystery author, Robert Parker. Well, it so happens that over the years, I've been a big fan of Robert Parker myself. And for a long time, I would have said he was my favorite mystery author. Unfortunately, he died about, I think, a year or two ago. And so I've moved on to some other new favorites. I just thought I'd throw in that additional synchronicity along with a great big thanks to you. Now here's one more from another faithful listener, Ralph, who writes from Germany. And he writes, Dear David, what amazing interviews I keep finding on your podcasts. I found a reference to your interview with Leslie Greenberg in the Unlocking the Emotional Brain book by Ecker, Hulley, and Tysik. I can remember getting into a real row with a therapist about 35 years ago on the subject of emotion being important in therapy. She thought I was talking rubbish. Anyhow, it was a great interview. Searching for that interview, I came across a reference to your Shrink Wrap interview number 227 with Rick Johnson. One thing that strikes me is that the writers who speak of Jung and Freud have obviously not read these writers in the original German. Now, I must confess that I read most of my Freud and Jung many years ago. Actually, he says, now I must confess that I read most of my Freud and Jung many years ago in English. I since then have learned German, but I have only read enough in German to know that there is a real confusion about how soul, self, and spirit should be translated. Now, I don't speak German, so I'm going to butcher it trying to render what Ralph has written here. He goes on to say, Geist is spirit, but it also means intellect. Geisteskrank means psychotic. Seele means soul, but also the deeper or greater self. Seelestörung means psychoneurosis. To add to the confusion, Jung's father was a Reformed Swiss pastor, and his mother was an alienist. Sometimes he is writing about the spiritual in the sense that we would understand it to mean in English. Sometimes he is not. Now, this confuses me. That brings me to another suggestion for an interview. Someone who is a real scholar and native German speaker who can explain this to us English speakers. I recommend Professor Georg Marcus. Marcus wrote a biography of Freud, and he can speak English far better than I can German. I don't know if you ever read Rollo May's Psychology and the Human Dilemma, but there's some interesting comments about Carl Rogers in the book. I know that Rogers' name comes up frequently in your interviews. May and Jung are some of the few writers on psychotherapy who spoke out against one-size-fits-all therapy. The therapist should always find out what the symptoms mean to the individual patient. This idea comes up again in the coherence therapy of Ecker, Holly, and Tissick. Many thanks, and that's from Ralph. And Ralph is kind. I've noticed a couple synchronicities here. Either my unconscious, your unconscious, something here. But you refer to my interview with Rick Johnson. And it just so happens that today's interview has been with a Johnson, in this case, Sue Johnson. And the other striking little synchronicity was that you referred to the emphasis on emotions and that the psychiatrist that you had consulted with years ago was skeptical about the role of emotion, the appropriate role of emotion in psychotherapy. And in fact, today's guest has really emphasized that in her emotionally focused therapy approach, couples therapy approach. So I find all of this fascinating. So thank you, Ralph. And I've got another email from you in my queue, which I will read in a future interview. So I think that better wrap it up once again for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Sue Johnson, for speaking with us about her book, Love Sense, The Revolutionary New Science of Romantic Relationships. Now, on the next episode, I'll be speaking with Dr. Ralph Metzger about his history with psychonauts Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, also known as Ram Dass. And we'll also be speaking about recent developments in research on psychedelics. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.